I'm Billy Fiata, and our topic today is the journey of wellness and subtitled For the Health of It. I've even got a t-shirt that says that on it today. You didn't see that. Okay. You do? Good, good. Okay. I don't know how close this is.
I don't think that's on.
Well, in talking about wellness, it's a term that a lot of people have difficulty with, and wonder what is the definition of wellness. I think we used to call it health, but wellness is a big industry now, particularly in corporations, but it's also important in other institutions, on our college campus.
We had the discussion on apartheid. It was last week we had a discussion on apartheid. Were any of you in on that?
Wellness has become a big and important issue.
But you won't mind if I do that for the benefit of the others, because when we're talking about politics...
I'm going to get you to work.
Sickness?
Pardon?
Absence of sickness?
Absence of sickness, okay. Any other ideas on what health is all about?
State of your physical and mental being.
State of your physical and mental being. All right.
Wholeness.
Health is wholeness. Anybody else got ideas on that?
Just feeling good, general. Feeling good.
Okay. Feeling good, sort of general well-being. Mm-hmm. Do you usually know when you're healthy?
I think it's somewhat of a relative thing.
Okay. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, I consider myself in real good health, but I have asthma and I have allergies and I have arthritis in my hands and I have, we'll see what else. But I have quite a few things, but I consider myself in very good health. Because compared to where I was, it's much better.
Okay, so it doesn't necessarily mean the absence of illness then.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And also, it depends on expectations too. With my hands, I don't expect not to have trouble with them.
So you've set a certain level of
expectation of what I consider
wellness, a state of wellness for. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, actually, health can be good or bad.
This is the rules that they started to lay out then.
I think, by definition, health is a condition of one's physical and, as someone else stated, emotional being.
That's sort of like the definition somebody gave, that health is something you have until you don't have it anymore.
What is Webster's definition?
Well, I didn't consult Webster, but the World Health Organization talks about it as a state of complete physical, mental, social well-being, not merely the absence or of disease or infirmity.
That's asking for a lot.
It is.
Do you know anybody who's got that?
A state of complete physical, mental, social well-being. Well, I suppose it's how you define that then. What is complete?
But in different degrees.
Mm-hmm. And you have different disabilities you're working with, but you still can be in a state of good health.
Right.
So it isn't perfection. That's not what we're striving for. Ivan Illich talked about health as a process of adaptation, during which one can actively change one's situation. And I think that's what you were talking about, where you adapt to situations that come up.
And you work towards you work towards improving that.
All right.
Mm-hmm. You know, like with me, I have asthma, and the stronger I am, the better off my asthma is. So I work towards building up my strength. And over the years, it's taken years, but over the years it has worked.
So it's not just adapting to whatever is a disability or some problem, but making, working towards changing it or improving the quality of your life in a way that's going to help you with that disability. Okay. Anybody disagree with that? Well, if that's health, what is wellness? I was in a debate, or not in the debate, but listened to a debate between two physicians in Minneapolis not too long ago. One was a very well-known surgeon at the University of Minnesota, and the other was a family physician that's been in self-care, medical self-care field for quite a while. And they had very different definitions on what health was or what wellness was. The one talked about, the surgeon talked about wellness as making sick people well, which is the absence then of sickness. And the medical self-care doctor talked about it as valuing the best possible for you and acting on it. Which would go along with what you're saying is the best possible state of health you can be in and then doing something about it. So wellness really includes more than health as we have known it. It is more inclusive in terms of promoting health and preventing illness, preventing a different stage of one's disability or illness, and educating oneself and taking more responsibility for one's own self health care. And then looking at it as a holistic approach, where it's not just my physical body, but it's my total person, wholeness. We are not fragmented, compartmentalized selves. We don't have a mind and a body and a spirit that are separate. Although I think some of that dualistic thinking is still apparent, and you probably run into it from time to time. I think the church has certainly propagated this in its earlier history, and probably there may be still some remnants of this, where the spirit and the mind are considered more important than the body. And it's actually the three are very much a part of a whole, because what happens with our physical body affects the way we think, the way we feel, the way we respond to other people. You can't separate them out. And yet most of us think in terms of illness, and we assume that the absence of illness indicates a level of wellness. I work with college students, and I think it's so apparent with that age group, because many of them have not experienced illness, and they're in the bloom of life, and don't think about doing certain things or making choices at that age that are going to make a difference for 10, 20, 30 years later. Kind of living now, and of course, they're healthy. So there are many degrees of wellness, just like there are many degrees of illness. I like the model. I've got it on the board here. You can take a look at it. It's called the Illness-Wellness Continuum. It's by a medical doctor that who now lives in California. His name is John Travis, and works a lot with wellness. He divides it into two areas here. Let me get my notes on this. Moving from the center here to the left. I don't know if you can all see this.
I wonder if we could get those little lights on something.
Okay. Okay, good. We have a neutral point right here in the center where there's no discernible illness or wellness. As you move farther to the left, it's a progressively worsening state of health. So you get to here, premature death. Moving from the center to the right indicates increasing levels of health and well-being. Now, the treatment model can bring you to this point. You have some illness where you start getting some signs of the illness, symptoms that you notice, and some kind of disability. You have something done with this. You go into the medical system, you go to the doctor, you have some kind of treatment model that takes care of it. It brings you back here. Now, a lot of people stay there rather than doing anything more with that. They come back to a kind of neutral point where, okay, I've had the problem taken care of, so I'm okay now. The wellness model moves all the way across, and instead of stopping at this neutral point, say you had some surgery. Once you have recovered from the surgery, instead of just going back to your former patterns of and lifestyle, you began to look at some causative factors for that and maybe make some changes. That's where the awareness of what was happening. What were the causative factors that led you into this area? Education, learning something about growing and moving, always moving towards a level, a higher level of wellness. Now, in the wellness model, you can be at any one of these points. And you're moving closer to a higher level. This model, the wellness model, is meant to be in harmony with the treatment model, not as a replacement for it, because you need this. So the two can work in harmony, not replace it. Any questions on that, or any thoughts or ideas?
Isn't this the new trend? I mean, previously, even before the, I don't know, X number of years, people would get sick, they'd have a heart attack, and they would maybe recover to the neutral point.
Mm-hmm.
And now, that's what the whole wellness thing has sprung up, because people have started running and doing all that stuff. In my parents' time, or my older sister's time, they would have just said, oh goody, we lived. And try to stay quiet and not start up the heart business again or whatever. And now we get to the neutral point and then tax ourselves by pushing ourselves more to be healthier yet. And I think that's a new concept for this generation. They don't realize that's probably why people died so young. The lifespan is stretching out partly because of all that stuff, I suppose. Is that right?
I think there's some evidence to this. Do you have any thoughts on that, Bob?
Yeah, Billy, I don't disagree with anything you said so far. I would
there's just a couple things that bother me about the wellness movement.
Okay.
In general. One is that the good part about the wellness movement is that mainly what's improved our life expectancy in our country over the last 30, 40, 50 years has been the abolishment of the handling of infectious diseases,
uh-huh.
and some things like that, immunizations, the absence of polio, the things that kill people in the 1940s. I've been in medical practice now I've been a physician for 20 years, and I've only seen one active case of tuberculosis. And in the 1940s and early 50s, there was a sanatorium in my city that was full of tuberculosis patients. That's mainly what thoracic surgeons did, was operate on TB patients. And so so most of what's improved our life expectancy has been that. Now we're entering a phase where what's killing people is heart disease, stroke, and cancer. People are now living long enough to get those kinds of diseases and dying of them. When the life expectancy in our country was 55 or 60, there just weren't that many people having strokes or heart disease. And now when the average life expectancy is in the 70s and 80s, they're coming into being. So our wellness emphasis is trying to do things to abolish those things. The only part about that bothers me, I think, kind of theoretically, it doesn't bother me at all because I buy into that. I think that the medical model of trying to improve life expectancy for, say, heart disease is kind of a losing battle. I think we're going to do angioplasties and bypass surgery and things like that to really improve life expectancy for heart disease is not going to do anywhere near as much as stopping smoking, cutting down our fats, and getting some exercise, and that type of thing. There's no doubt about that. But what bothers me is that if everyone's so driven now to try to get rid of those three major causes of death, and I can assure you, when we have a cure for cancer and can control heart disease and stroke, we're going to have something else. We're going to have Alzheimer's disease. We've got Alzheimer's disease. Alzheimer's disease was no problem 20 years ago. Now we have Alzheimer's support groups. We're going to have those kinds of problems. And so what bothers me theoretically about the wellness movement is that we're not going to make ourselves well. I mean, we're all going to die. And I don't like to see people spend their whole lives worrying about staying well and utilizing all their energy to stay well. When as a society, we're going to run into death in some form.
I think you're absolutely right that we're all going to die of something.
Yeah.
But does one have some choice?
Sure.
You brought up an important issue of lifestyle that we're no longer dying from infectious diseases or from an earlier period of plagues or problems. Oh, we have a new plague. We have the AIDS, yes. Because of changes in not only medical advancements and antibiotics that have certainly been a big help, but also
I guess what I'm saying, Billy, is that, and I don't think you disagree with this, spending your whole life trying to stay well isn't wellness.
I think spending your whole life trying to do anything isn't a good thing. Yes.
I think the important thing is the one diagram you have on here with the six areas. And, you know, the physical or the wellness is only one aspect of that. You know, you want to be physically well and you want to take care of your body. But there are still the other five areas that you have to keep in balance in order to have a full, healthy existence. And I think that's the key to everything, is just having that balance between all six areas.
When I talk about wellness, and probably should have subtitled this, wellness is not only aerobics or good nutrition. That's a part of it. But wellness is a holistic response to now, to future. It is taking care of oneself and being attentive to the different parts of what constitute my life. Now, it doesn't mean that I'm going to be working 95% on all of these areas at the same time. In working with college students, this is the area that they're working heavily in, the intellectual, and also social. Maybe some physical, emotional, we try to work on that. Maybe a little spiritual, vocational becomes more important as they move towards their junior, senior year. And that's true with any one of us, I think, that we're going to be working on more concerned about one of these areas at different times, different periods in our life. For me, it's trying to see them as in a totality and keeping some kind of a balance, not deciding I'm going to be spending X number of hours in each one of these, trying to be well. Any other thoughts about this or comments related to what Bob was talking about?
I was thinking too, like she was, that people were mentioning heart attacks and TB and all that, and my mind was going more toward my emotional and mental health. I was thinking of that because I've never had a physical illness of any kind. Mm-hmm. Hangnail mm-hmm. just about throws mm-hmm. me. but my emotional life and my mental health has been jeopardized just enough times to know that I'm so set on making sure that that's well that, and I don't believe that striking out for the wellness is necessarily well either, but I mean the balance. I'm so for quality of life that I have to admit that if something happened to me that would jeopardize my mental and emotional health and physical, I don't know that I'd want to be around. That's where I am with it. And yet I know that coping skills with those kind of diseases are important, but quality is so important that...
And how much do you think that working on your emotional skills and mental health is affecting the lack of physical problems?
You mean an undue...
I mean, you may be contributing in a very positive way to keeping yourself healthy.
You mean by attending to the mental
and physical? You talked about, right, the mental and emotional aspect of yourself.
Well, I believe that it does, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
How much do they influence each other?
Tremendous.
You know, people can, I see a lot of people at the neutral point that they lack any physical symptoms, and yet they may be very bored or depressed, maybe anxious, or just generally unhappy with their lives. What effect is that going to have on some of these other aspects of their life?
Weren't there studies, a bunch of studies done on people who grow old together in couples and people who grow old as single people and are widowed and stuff? And one of the ones that I read recently was just about young people, young, you know, yuppies, 20s, 30s, early 40s, that were single and all the maladies that they have. They're out there running and jogging, but they have these maladies. Malaise, is that the word?
Mm-hmm.
Because nobody's tending to their emotional needs. So they tend to them by going to the doctor to see about the gout in their toe or whatever. I'm thinking of a particular friend who's 33 and has gout in his toe, you know.
Well, I have read some statistics, and Bob, you may, I don't know whether you agree or disagree with this, that something like 90% to 95% of physical complaints that have some kind of psychosocial aspect to them.
I don't think there's any doubt about mm-hmm. that probably 80% of the people who have physical complaints have something else wrong, you know, besides that, that's really causing their symptoms. Mm-hmm. No,
and they present with a physical complaint.
Physical complaint.
Right.
Backache, mm-hmm. chest pain, you name it, shortness of breath.
Mm-hmm.
But the other aspect about this that I think is really true, to kind of expand on what she said, is that if you have these other things in place, we see this every day in taking care of people with cancer. If somebody, responds to a serious, devastating physical illness, they do much better with it, whether they're cured or whether they're not, if the rest of those areas are intact, if the rest of the wellness areas that you described are intact. I mean, you can't put them in place if they're not there already.
Mm-hmm.
But if they're intact, it makes the handling of the physical illness a whole lot easier. For both.
So you see people having the same kind of cancer or
right.
in.
Right.
But in various states of
yeah.
of
yeah,
illness,
there are,
because
there are
of
people where the illness will devastate them because they don't have any, they don't have family, they don't have friends, they don't have any religious faith, they don't have any support systems, and you can't drum those up at those kinds of
mm-hmm.
times.
Mm-hmm.
And there's other people who get an equally the same illness, who will kind of work the illness into their life. I mean, they don't revolve their lives around the illness. They, and that's, believe it or not, for the medical people, that's a pleasure to see people like that who consider coming to you a pain in the neck. They want to keep on with their lives, they want to keep on running, they want to keep on traveling. They have to work around their chemotherapy treatments and all the other stuff going on.
Huh.
There are people like that. So those are well people. Even though they have cancer, they're still well.
But wouldn't you say then that they have been working on wellness?
Sure, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But working on it in a...
Been working on it or have been lucky enough to have it, to have it a natural part of their life without cancer.
Sure, you can't discount family history. I think that's a part of probably some of the signs here that might be a good thing to be in touch with, what your family history is and what that means in terms of... expectations for yourself. I had a good friend that he had a family history of heart disease. Her father died at age 39, her brother died at age 32. She and her sister were the only ones left. She ignored completely that family history and some of the things you were talking about. She was a heavy smoker, a moderate social drinker, very much overweight, which are all factors that she had some choice in changing. She ignored that completely, and she died a very early death, too, from heart disease. So there are some choices in this. And if she had been aware of some of the signs, not only of family history, but also within herself, she could have made some choices that might have made a difference. Now, tomorrow we're going to get into some of the choices. And not everybody chooses this kind of a wellness model. And you have to respect people's choices. But it does provide, given general good health and family history that's going to be somewhat supportive, working in some of these areas is going to give you a head start. If you do develop some problems so that you do have some supports in place.
I was interested to hear Bob say that about the overwellness business because I'm sure all of us know people who get totally preoccupied by some aspect of wellness, either running or they're not eating any fats that week and they'll usually get on some tangent, and then I come from long-lived family, and it's like that card that somebody gave my dad. Growing old is pigeon poop, is what it says. And he was struggling with my mother's Alzheimer's and his bone cancer. He was a lot of pain. And indeed it is pigeon poop to watch. And I was asking these people, what gives anyone live so long? I mean, I'd rather have an ice cream cone and knock off a couple of years at the end. And that's what you're talking about. I assume that you're gonna die of something and then you spend your whole life denying certain pleasures that usually changes from month to month or whatever. And I would rather
But there are a lot of people that dying prematurely because they've been smoking and doing all this stuff that, you know, that it's no fun to die of Alzheimer's disease when you're 105, but it's no fun to die of lung cancer when you're 45 either.
But don't you always suspect, I know this is presumptuous, but I always suspect those people want to leave in some part of their hearts. Some of those people, I think, want out of here. And I confronted one person smoking away. It was a therapist. And I said, you know, I always think you people who know all this stuff and are smoking are a little bit suicidal. Well, there might be something to do that. It's a self-destructive kind of a thing. And if they cared so much about living, they're weighing. They cared that much about living, they put that thing out. And they go to a smoking clinic or they do something. But something makes them not care very much about this house that they're living in here.
I think that raises a significant question, Julie. And it's something that, that John, you talked about in your session too. And William Knowles, who's a doctor, wrote a book, edited a book. It was written by several healthcare professionals about 10 years ago. I forgot the name of it. Something about knowing more and feeling worse.
Doing better.
Doing better and feeling worse, that's it. Mm-hmm. That
yes.
We have so much more information about health and wellness, and yet people are choosing, a few, you know, are into the wellness thing, but a lot of us are not doing anything about it, or maybe choosing to continue patterns that we know are going to be destructive for us. What do you think that is?
I think my opinion is that they're ignoring some basic thing over there in that circle, and I suspect a lot of it is spiritual and lack of love all the way back. And so I know, for instance, my aunt is a heavy smoker, and she's divorced and alone now, and she spent $400 to quit smoking, and she felt lonely when she quit smoking. She knew it. She's smoking again. She knew that was feeding something.
So it's providing, it's meeting a need.
She feels better when she's smoking, and it is meeting her loneliness need.
Smoking is just an incredible thing. That smoking, you know, people want to find a cure for cancer. If everybody stopped smoking, we'd get rid of about 40% of it. And but smoking is a little bit different, because I think smoking, as the Surgeon General just finally pointed out, it really is an addiction.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And people who've tried to get people to stop smoking, which I've been doing for a long time, I can count probably on both my hands people that have stopped smoking because I told them they should, because they had a health problem and I told them they should. They just don't.
But they needed permission from an authority figure.
Right. What's made people really stop smoking lately has been that they can't smoke in the airplanes, they can't smoke in the restaurants, they can't smoke at cocktail parties, because there's a lot of people interested in wellness now. They don't want, now there's evidence that secondhand smoke is injurious to you. That's what's really stopped people from smoking. It's the social pressure that people are starting to feel like lepers if they smoke. That's done more good than any harping medical people have ever done.
Well, if we could find some way of stopping to introducing cigarettes to teenagers and young people. Something needs to be done to the tobacco firms. They pass out samples of cigarettes at the rock concerts and things like that. And a lot of youngsters get started that way.
But they're fighting a tooth and nail, aren't they? Any kind of restrictions on their turf. They've got some strong lobbies, but
again, the commercials that are coming out for teenagers on social issues, that you're going to smell bad, you have bad breath, I think are really making an impact, because they are not coming at it from the idea that you're going to die early, because they're not going to think about that. They're doing it, your clothes are going to stink, you're going to smell bad breath, and the kids are knocking over on the commercial. I think that's what's going to catch them.
What do you think is catching them there? Is it all closer to home? Something that's more
kissing.
Personalized?
Kissing.
Kissing.
Bad breath, it's the universal fear. I think it is.
Being socially acceptable is their prime goal at that age, now that they're going to die. That's too far off in the future for them to handle. They're grasping today, I don't want to smell bad.
Education and smoking otherwise hasn't worked. There's never been in the last 10 years, you know, in the 1950s and 60s, we didn't even have anything in our schools about not smoking. Now our kids are getting it with both barrels, and yet the biggest group of new smokers are teenage girls coming out of high school smoking. Mm-hmm. So the educational process about scaring them to death hasn't been working. You're right, though. I think having bad breath and having other people being mad at you because they might be inhaling your smoke is going to affect them more.
Plus, they're working on models. I think, you know, our school in Bloomington, Minnesota has just become a smoke-free school. The teachers now are not allowed to smoke within the school, or, you know, people coming to visit or whatever.
It's the accepted model, and something that you go on with.
I think one thing that's making women stop is when they become pregnant and they realize that it's going to affect their baby. That hits home.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If you feel that you're destroying another life along with your own.
And you're both sort of saying something similar, that it hits home when it's something that is personal to you, something where you're at.
Did you see that tobacco company lost a lawsuit last week, or just this week?
No, I didn't read that.
That man sued them for his wife's death. She smoked 40 years.
And he won?
And he won.
He did?
Yeah, that just happened 2 days ago in the paper.
They mounted a big
Lippert or something company.
Yeah,
that was a man that had a lawsuit against a tobacco company because of his wife's death. She smoked 40 years. He won the lawsuit.
Yes, I know.
That's based on the fact that
she began smoking prior to all the health warnings, and then had become
addicted
prior to the awareness. But I understand there's somebody was explaining it to me, and that they would not be awarded, nor near the amount. Wasn't it $200,000 or $400,000, something like that?
Well, they were asking in millions.
Yeah, but they didn't get that. They weren't awarded that. And that even it would even be lessened, and I didn't quite understand it all, the reasoning, but they would derive very little from it in the end.
But it sets a precedent, because isn't it the first one that
they lost?
Yeah, the folks lost one.
Well, I think probably the first suit probably is.
Well, there's been since, but the tobacco companies have always won.
So you see it as a real tournament?
From what I've read about it, it is.
Mm-hmm.
That they actually won this time.
What about other thoughts on what Julie was talking about before? That do you think that many of us sort of court death in a way by the lifestyle we lead, and a premature death, that we want it because we're lonely or frustrated or depressed or are not getting our needs met in other ways?
Do you mean that in a conscious sense?
No,
I don't think it's a conscious.
It's that emptiness inside that you can't name and you haven't been able to feed, and so you put the bad things on to soothe that emptiness. And those are the words, by the way, of a mutual friend who's an alcoholic. And she drank for the same reasons that my aunt, my dear socially charming aunt, smokes. Another single woman, by the way, is an alcoholic, and she drank to fill the emptiness inside. And she did. She is a recovering alcoholic, and now she eats.
Or
nurturing. And she says that word, nurturing. So I think a lot of us have such a neediness that we want it to get over with. How long do we have to live this way? But we might not be able to say it even to ourselves. I think most of it's underground.
I think the amount of illegal drug abuse that goes on in this country is a pretty good sign of...
Yeah, that's a great example.
You know, how many people probably have unmet needs and, mm-hmm. you know, look at crack, you know, stuff like that.
Radically self-destructive. Mm-hmm. Totally dangerously self-destructive. And expensively self-destructive. How else can you explain something like that when you think about it? Why? I mean, it can't be that great of a kick that you could spend that much money.
Well, and then it becomes an addictive process again.
Those kind of things just have to do with our lifestyle, you know. They actually have to do with our abundance. They have to do with our leisure time, our abundance of leisure time, our abundance of money, our abundance of refined foods, and that kind of stuff. There's no drug abuse in Guatemala hardly at all. There's no lack of cocaine down there. It's just that nobody can afford to buy it.
So if you're on a survival basis, you don't have the money or the,
yeah, you know,
the time.
People in our country think they're under such tremendous mm-hmm. stress. You know, there's a lot of the stress we have is just due to our abundance. People that don't have the abundance have a lot more stresses, different kinds of stresses. So I think we can't be sympathetic for the stresses we have, but I think we have to look at what the causes really are.
What happened in Rome when they got everything but they didn't have anything really. Haven't we seen this pattern before somewhere in history where life got so comfortable and then as life got more and more comfortable that the meaning sort of receded in an inverse proportion and people ended up sick at heart. Rich at the bank, sick at heart. Decadence.
And we're probably seeing more of that.
Yeah.
And it goes along with what you were talking about, John, in your sessions too, with the this lack of sense of community, where there is some awareness and ministering to and nurturing this in people.
Well, there would be some self-destructive behavior, I assume. It would be the result of loneliness or the desire to escape from problems or stress or life's miserable, there's no future, and that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. But there are probably a lot of us engage in self-destructive behavior on a lesser way because we have such trust that the medical system is the umbrella that will patch us up if anything goes wrong. We have sort of this protective shield. There's a kind of confidence that we can do things to ourselves and somebody will patch us up. So
you see that as still being pretty pervasive at some level
in our thinking. In Central America, again, the example, say an automobile. Everybody who has an automobile knows how to take care of it. Because they know if something goes wrong, they just can't go down to the mechanic. So they really know how to keep their cars together because no one's going to fix it if it goes wrong. And I don't know anything about my car and I don't take that good care of it because I know that if something goes wrong, an expert's going to fix it up. And I think a lot of times we feel the same way about our health. That if, I don't have to know much about my body. Somebody else.
Lung cancer is a classic example. People who smoke want to come in and get chest x-rays all the time. They're afraid of lung cancer. They want to smoke, but they don't want to get lung cancer. And so they figure, you know, if I come in and get chest x-rays often enough, they'll pick it up early and they can cut it out and I'll be just fine.
So it's kind of playing Russian roulette.
Well, what they don't know is that even if by the time you see it on a chest x-ray, you're already in trouble. And that if you take everybody who's getting this lung cancer, the ones that are surgically resectable and the ones who aren't, the whole continuum of people with lung cancer, 11% live 5 years. And so you're going to be 89% of the time, by the time your chest x-ray is positive, you're already a goner. And, that's not, you can tell people that, but certainly our public doesn't know that. But that's the case. But people already feel, as John said, you're going to get bailed out. They'll find it and get it early enough and get it cut out of there and everything will be fine. And it won't be fine. That's true for a lot of different things.
I heard a statistic, and I don't remember the numbers, on NPR. They were giving a little report on the study of quitting smoking. And the group least likely to quit smoking was the group that had been urged to quit by their doctor for medical reasons, like quit or die. Those people didn't quit. The people who were most likely to quit would be like people who just decided they should, or their children said, "Daddy, please don't die," and that kind of stuff worked better. But that must be it. They know their risk. They go in, the doctor will just cut it out.
Or if they see someone with emphysema and see what they go through.
That does not work.
I've known people who quit because of that.
I know people whose dad has emphysema and is dying at this minute, Carl's dad, and his brother sneaks his cigarettes still. He's overweight and wheezing.
Well, he may have a death wish.
Yep.
So I think from a medical side, then, really what I would say is that I think wellness has a lot of, the blue side of your graph there has a lot of value in it, actually even in a scientific sense, in that now we know that there are people who, as you said, who have a hereditary predisposition to heart disease, women who have a lot of breast cancer in the family have to take extra precautions, people who... that type of thing. So, there's oncogenes that people. Some people can smoke 4 packs of cigarettes a day up to 90, and others can't.
Mm-hmm.
But still, I think the negative side of that, the thing that scares me about the wellness thing, is it gets to be a lot of people who I associate with high level wellness are people who are really introverted. Self-directed people, means self-centered people, who, and that bothers me some, because they really kind of have the feeling that if I just do all these things, somehow or other I'm going to kind of live forever. If we adopt that as a society, I think it's going to be, I'm not sure how good that's going to be, plus the fact that, as I mentioned earlier, when we get rid of heart disease, cancer, and stroke, we're going to have Alzheimer's disease, and you're all going to die of something. We're not going to be able to prevent everything.
Well, you're really seeing it historically, too, that there were other diseases that people died of before, and now we have heart disease and cancer and strokes, accidents. Right. And if we confront them and move beyond that, there's going to be a whole other...
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. More frustrating, much more frustrating. We're just starting to see the beginning of a new bunch of diseases that are going to be harder to deal with, harder to diagnose, harder to treat, harder to deal with sociologically than heart disease and cancer ever were, because people aren't going to die of them very readily. Their hearts and their lungs are going to be intact, and their brains are going to be gone.
So what do? Sort of give up in desperation?
There has to be a balance.
I think that's what that circle is a balance. I think you're thinking more of the physical side, and I think if you think about the social environment and the vocational and the spiritual, if you balance that with the other things that are more individualized, then it becomes more of a balance. And that's what I think of wellness as being, involving not just the physical side and the physical health, but with the social health and the vocational health. Things that involve other people in the community spirit.
And actually, that fits what Julie was talking about. If some of your other needs are met through spiritual emotion, if you're able to express your emotions in ways that release some of that loneliness, that anxiety, if there is some social and spiritual kind of supports there, perhaps you don't need to use some of these other, abuse your body in ways that we often do. Yes?
I think along with that balance too, I think we can be too much of just looking at myself and what I can do to keep well and just become kind of too self-centered, whereas a person who is more outgoing and concerned about others and of course, there again, you need balance, not just go overboard and kill yourself doing things for others. But I think there's a danger of spending too much time on trying to each individual and try and do something for my own health. And I can't do anything for anyone else because I'm too busy doing my own thing and working out my own health.
Yeah, I think the health is a community. You have healthy communities or healthy nations. Often we figure out each individual finding health. Well, I think the countries that have the worst health statistics, often the solution to that is not more nurses and doctors and therapies, but cleaner water and land distribution and work relations and sort of healthier relationships. And so I think the struggle is to try to find healthy communities, healthy workplaces, healthy environments, healthy patterns.
Cooperative idea of working together.
Not to neglect the fact that we're all going to need, or many of us will need, the intervention of some health experts from time to time, but often health is a matter of working together.
But I think ultimately, though, it starts with the individual, and if they have a healthy, well-balanced life, they're going to want to have a healthy relationship, a healthy marriage, a healthy family, a healthy community, so that you are forming a network of support. And you can support and help each other instead of having to rely on the institution. But I think with the breakdown of the family and everyone being so selfish and thinking about their own upward mobility, that there has been a loss of community and over-reliance on the institutions. So I guess I see the breakdown of the family. This is getting back to your lecture, yeah. But in a way they're also interrelated. But
I know a group in Chicago on the west side decided to do some health research, mm-hmm. and they decided to explore what people were coming to the hospital for. It was the inner city community, yeah. And there were a lot of children were coming because of accidents. They were hit by cars, and mm-hmm. there were a lot of dog and rat bites. Now, the solution to rat bites is not more nurses.
Exactly.
The solution to more accidents is not more clinics. So they organized together and got some stop signs put in. They had some boundaries and got the rats taken care of. So often, right. the health solution to health problems is a kind of communal action.
And I think that's a good point that you brought up and that you had spoken to, that it's not something that one does only for oneself, that it is in relation to other people. And that's probably some of the negative aspects that you're talking about, Bob, in the wellness movement, where this emphasis on
the self,
yeah. Improving the self, if you do all this now, then this is the reward, mm-hmm.
And it's more the wellness movement is more accessible to the middle and upper class that can go out and jog,
exactly.
and have leisure time, mm-hmm. and can.
It's becoming, the wellness movement has become institutionalized. It's moved, from taking care of oneself and finding ways of adding to the quality of your life and the life of the people and community that you live with,
to a big industry with these experts out here setting up programs and these plethora of books now on wellness that that you can plug into. It's a big industry.
I think a big concern of us who are elderly is we don't want to become a burden to our children. So we put forth extra effort to be as well as possible, as long as possible, so that we don't become a burden.
That's a good point, yes. Do you want to talk about that at all? How maybe that leads us into our topic for tomorrow, which is going to be choices. How one makes choices around wellness. And we'll save that for tomorrow then.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Bob, did you have something else to add?
Well, I was just going to say, you had mentioned earlier in your talk about what most people come to the healthcare system for, what their complaints are, and mm-hmm. kind of mentioned a few. It was always interesting to me. I took my specialty training at the Mayo Clinic, and the Mayo Clinic is the biggest private practice in medicine in the world. And they see more, everybody in medicine knows that they see more diseases of a certain kind and different kinds of unusual diseases than almost anyone else in the world. But they see them all by accident. That the biggest reason that people come in, when they look at people coming through the doors, the number one problem is backache, the number two problem is headache. And when you're a physician at the Mayo Clinic, you hardly write any prescriptions. There's hardly any prescriptions written, because most of what they do is deal with the rest of this. And the reason that the people who go there think it's so wonderful is because what they try to do is get at the rest of the stuff in their pie there. Realizing that the minute most of the people who are practicing there know, they've been out there a long time, they've seen thousands of people, they know the minute the person opens their mouth that they're not going to write any prescriptions and they're not going to find anything physically wrong with them. And most of what happens is that they wind up trying to deal with the rest of it as best they can in that kind of a model, which really has its shortcomings, because they're out of the community and they're out of their family setting and they're out of town and everything else. But they try to do that. But 80% of them, and yet what happens when they try to do x-rays and try to reassure the person that they're well, quote unquote, they find something else wrong by accident. And that's actually what happens. And they readily know that. And their whole system is designed for that. That very few people come there and get into the hospital. People coming from out of town think they're going to be put in a hospital where just a very small percentage of them are ever found to be sick enough to wind up in the hospital. Hmm. Most of them wind up in the clinic and go home without any medicine.
But you're saying they have attended to some of these other areas.
They try to, mm-hmm. but they, mm-hmm. they can't do it very well. Because people are coming from, 300-500 miles away, it's expensive mm-hmm. to stay there. They have to stay in a hotel. They can't get in the hospital. And they have to wait around for appointments. And it's there's limitations too, but they do try to do that. And that's why people like it. That's why it's got a good reputation. Not because they do any better with heart disease, cancer, and stroke than anybody else. But what they do is deal with the rest. They're trying to deal with the rest of the planet.
Well, it was an interesting article, and maybe being from Bloomington, you saw that in the Minneapolis Tribune sometime this last spring, where it talked about changes in how physicians look at patients that come to the clinics, that it used to be come in for an annual physical, various tests were done, and very little talking was done to the person. And what they're saying now is you don't need as many tests, and maybe you don't need to have an annual physical, but they're asking more questions about the person's lifestyle.
That's one of the things that I thought about when you made that remark was, I've been a programmer for 10 years now, and when in the early couple of years as a programmer, I'd go to the doctor for something, and they never asked me if I was in school, if I was married, if I did anything, if I worked outside the home or anything like that. But in the last couple of years, I have noticed that when I go to a new doctor, one of the very first things they ask me is, do you work outside the home? And I say, yes. And they say, what do you do? And I say, I'm a programmer. And their second question is that a high-stress programming job? And I never would have been asked that 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. But now, mm-hmm. you know, and then I say yes, and then they write it down. Mm-hmm. And that has been a definite change that I've noticed. And it's happened to me enough that, you know, I picked up on the fact that they did ask me that.
I think we're beginning to see some changes and trends there. And they talked about it from the Mayo Clinic as well, that physicians there were looking at many of these other aspects of a person and asking questions around that to get a profile of the person that said something about what their state of health was, rather than just putting them through tests and giving medications and then.
Becoming more holistic then, where they're looking at the entire individual, mm-hmm. just not one mm-hmm. segment.
And if that isn't being done, I think that's something that we as consumers can ask to be addressed. And that is something that I want to talk about some more tomorrow in our session tomorrow, where we talk about choices, changes, and challenges, and look at ways that we can move towards a higher level of wellness for ourselves and for our families and for our communities. And I'd be interested in you sharing your stories, too, about this, what has been helpful for you.